Yesterday, we looked at an introductory concept of relationships. Recognize that all of us are building relationships. Question is how and on what are we building our relationships? And I said that my belief is that interpersonal relationships need to be built upon solid relationship with God. In doing that, I looked at some of the teachings of Jesus. One day when he was confronted by people who were not really getting along with him well, they asked him a question, and it seems as though the intent was to trip him, to trap him, to get him to say something so they could accuse him. And the question was, what is the great commandment in the law? And Jesus said, the greatest commandment is to love God with all your heart. Now, Jesus did what good teachers do. He gave them more than they asked for. He said, the second is like the first. The second greatest command is, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And then he said, on these two commands hang all the law and the prophets. Whatever God has said that we are to do or not to do, whatever instructions he gives us for living, are simply explaining how to love him or how to love others. On these two commands hang all the law and the prophets. And so, in my instructions to you about relationships this week, my responsibility is to illuminate love. Love for God and love for others. And we must not separate the two. I'm going to begin today. Today we're going to be looking at the call to love and what it means to love in relationships. It's a big subject. It's more than I will be able to cover. There's so much in the scriptures about love, how to love one another. I'd like to begin with a story of Vincenzo Riccardi. This is a tragic story. It goes back to about 2.5 years ago, February 15th of 2007, the police were summoned to his house by a neighbor. And the neighbor noticed that apparently a water pipe had burst. And so the police came to check it out. There was it was wintertime, and there was frozen water coming from somewhere around the garage. And so the police came out, and they discovered that this man, Riccardi, was dead. And as they checked this out, they came to realize there's tragedy here. This man has been dead for a long time. He had been dead for 13 months. I'll quote from an article here. A neighbor called police after she noticed a pipe had burst in his house. His double door garage was cloaked in a frozen waterfall. Police discovered the man inside, still as the icy water, his television set buzzing, his living room blanketed with dead flies. His electric bills had gone unpaid, but the company had, for some inexplicable reason, not shut off the power. Warm air had preserved his face almost perfectly, like a dried rose. In the investigation that followed, they put together the story. They discovered the time of his death partially by the dates on perishable foods in his refrigerator and on his table. They found that, by the way, he was both blind and diabetic. He was 71 when they found him. He had died when he was 70 years old. And there was a lady named Adriana Molina who had learned to know him in 2003. She was a lady who operated a cleaning service, and she often cleaned for older people. And she came to find that older people needed somebody to talk to even more than they needed cleaning their houses at times. And she'd been referred to Riccardi by one of her clients. And she went there one day with her daughter, Kelly. And Riccardi was actually fairly rude to her. And she talked about cleaning, and he said, "Well, I'd like for you to clean the house, clean the upstairs and downstairs, $20, take it or leave it." Her daughter, Kelly, gave her mother a look that said, "Don't do it. $20 is not enough. Besides, this guy is rude and unappreciative and unrealistic." I quote again from the article, "The kitchen was covered in grease from steaks he had cooked, discolored button-down shirts," he mixed colors and washers, "hung all over the place because he had no dryer. He had left spoiled food on the lawn, saying it was for the animals. The upstairs had a separate kitchen and roomfuls of vintage furniture. It was left almost untouched because Riccardi stayed on the first floor to avoid stumbling on the stairs." Molina told her daughter not to worry about the money or the filth. This guy needs help. And so she began cleaning for him and interacting with him. She found that Riccardi's wife had left him a number of years before this, and then shortly after that had died. They had a son, and Molina tried to make contact with him, and phone calls were never returned. In the next couple of years, as she cleaned for him and interacted with him, he became increasingly paranoid and began to accuse her of trying to kill him, putting things in his food and so on. And one day, he became violent. He began swinging his cane at her, and she would duck out of the way and so on, and began accusing her again, and finally told her to leave. He said, "Get out. I've actually hired a nurse to look after me." And by that time, she had been caring for a number of other elderly people, and she was worn out, also trying to look after her own family. And she went out in the car and cried. And she said, "God, I can't." That was in December of 2006. And as clearly as I could tell, in January of 2007, Riccardi died. Los Angeles Times recorded this. This happened in New York State, by the way. Los Angeles Times reported this as he died in vast isolation. I want to talk to you today about love. And love is that which draws people together. It has to do with interaction. We live in a culture of broken relationships, people who are lonely, people who have distanced themselves from others, who have attempted to relate and then distance, who have broken interaction with others. I'd like to read now the opening verses of 1 Corinthians 13. They are familiar verses, and there's probably no place in the scripture where love is more succinctly and beautifully described to us. The opening verses talk about the importance of love. And so they are familiar words to us, but I encourage you to just think with me about your relationships as I read these verses. Paul writing, 1 Corinthians 13, verse 1, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I am become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Whatever relationships we have, whatever responsibilities we have, we can apply those verses, that call. We are called to love. And if we attempt to do all the things that need to be done, even if we attempt to obey what God has instructed us to do, and we do that without love, we've missed the point. Remember from yesterday, I said that the first commandment is to love, and sometimes when Jesus pulls this out and puts it at the top, it helps us to understand when we think about lists of things to do. And if we don't do the first thing, if we don't do the most important thing, the other things lose their significance. You ever play ball in school with your students? You ever have a student who really would like to hit a home run one day? And so when they get up to bat, instead of hitting the ball, they just, when the ball is pitched, they drop the bat and go running around the bases. You'd say, wait a minute, what are you doing? And the student, if the student were to respond saying, well, I'm making a home run, you'd say, no, there's no point running. Why? I'm making a home run. They score. Say, I made a home run. No, you didn't. You didn't hit the ball. In order to run and actually it accomplish something, you need to hit the ball. We sometimes expend a lot of energy doing, but if we haven't done the first thing, it doesn't matter. And so let's think about what love is. Love is a commitment. Always when I look at statements like this, I struggle because, as we've been reminded this morning, words can be powerful, but words that are not incarnated don't mean as much to us. But love is a commitment. It's demonstrated by loyalty, by commitment, by looking at what is best for others. We often associate love with feelings, and love, fortunately, is typically not devoid of feelings. It normally has feelings, but not always. And love is best demonstrated by that commitment that says, I am thinking of your best, and I will act in your best interest. A friend loves at all times. A friend is committed through anything. Now, I will back up here a bit, and again, it's difficult not to move down bunny trails here on this subject, but this is one you may want to pursue otherwise. Consider, what is a friend? In our culture, friend has connotations of kind of what, nice, fun interactions. In the Old Testament times, a friend was somebody who had covenanted with another person. A friend was somebody, actually the word comes from, I understand the Hebrew word comes from a word that means to cut. And friends would actually cut themselves in a commitment made to each other. And that commitment was a commitment that actually put their life on the line to each other. And so a man who had a number of cuttings had a number of people committed to him through anything. And so that's the concept here. When a friend sticks closer than a brother, a friend is somebody who has made a cutting, who has made a commitment to you. It also illuminates our understanding of Abraham as the friend of God. And you can explore that if you wish further. But love is a commitment that we make to the good of others. Love's commitment is always expressed. Now love, when we talk about the expression of love here, love is always deeper than its expression. And as we interact in relationships, especially where love goes deep, we will find ourselves in this situation where we have something inside of us that begs for words, that begs for expression, and everything we say falls short of what is in there. Love is always deeper than its expression, but love, true love, is always expressed. When we think about love, whether it's in the classroom, in our congregations, in our family, we typically associate love with such things as thoughtfulness, goodwill, kindness, compassion, warmth, belonging. And you may add additional words. What does love mean to you? You will find that you express love, you describe love in terms of its expression. You describe it, you think about love in the way you have experienced it from others. Again, love will always be deeper than those expressions, and that's what makes it mysterious, and that's what makes it something which we long for and something which we enjoy experiencing, because it ends up touching us in ways that we want to express, but we can never do it fully. And so there's always something of a longing quality about love. Love is a commitment. Love seeks expression. And now, love is of God. I would like to read a number of verses now from John's first letter. What I've been saying about love here is said so well by John. Verse 7. 1 John chapter 4, verse 7, Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. Now, you notice that even God's love seeks expression. In this, the love of God was manifested toward us, that God sent his only begotten Son into the world that we might live through him. In this is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. And so think with me, perhaps this diagram will help you to think about this. Love is of God. God's love was expressed. It was, in the words of other biblical writers, poured out upon us. It was lavished upon us. It was showered. It was just deluged. We have been deluged with the love of God. It's been poured out upon us. And God did this for reasons that he's told us, and probably for reasons that he has not told us. His love, according to those who have wrestled with it long and tried to understand it and tried to verbalize it, end up saying his love doesn't know boundaries. It is bottomless and it is beyond understanding. It has no east or west. And so there are dimensions to his love that we don't fully understand, but we know that one of the reasons he loved us was so that we might come back to loving him. And instead of a commitment to ourselves, a devotion to me, we begin this devotion to him. We respond back to him. Love is of God. We love him, John writes later, because he first loved us. And some, I don't know which John actually wrote. Some of the Greek manuscripts do not have him in there. We love because he first loved us. Our ability to love is of him. Love is of God. Now, what John says, and what Jesus also indicated, is that our love for God can never stay there just as love for him, because he is love, he loves us, and he changes us and causes us to become loving, which is expressed first in love for him, but it is also expressed then in our relationships with others. And so this union that we have with God, this love union with him, where he loves us and we love him, has offspring. It has outgrowth. We become loving, and the love that we have received and the love that we give back to him goes out to others. This love of God needs to become love in us. Love that takes on the same characteristics as God's love for us. We are told that we are to love as he has loved. We're to love others as he has loved us. So, if we think about the love that is going out from us, is it love? Well, let's pause here and just insert something. Our tendency is to use words to define love as we understand it. And we can easily misrepresent what love is. In fact, I get angry sometimes, if that's permitted, when I hear the distortions of love. I don't know if Satan has got away with any other deceptions, like deceptions that surround love. People actually describe selfishness as love today. They have for a long time. We have. It's easy for us to define love as that which I like, that which pleases me. That is love. And if you don't please me, you don't love me. And particularly if you cause me pain, you don't love me. Now, I don't have time to move down this. In fact, I don't fully understand it myself, but it seems to me that in a fallen world, you cannot love without pain. You cannot love without sometimes causing pain, and certainly not without experiencing pain. It's impossible in a fallen world not to experience pain in love. And so we must come back to, what is this love? What tells me how to love my students? What tells me how to love my fellow teachers? What tells me how to love the parents of my students? What tells me how to love my brothers and sisters? Love is of God. God is love. So a study of love is a study of God. And we learn to know what love is by learning to know who God is. Now, I do want to say here, just insert here, that we must not make the mistake of switching those and say, love is God. God is more than love, but God is love. The scriptures describe who God is in many of those statements. God is. But God is love. That's the one we're looking at, and we're saying that we will learn how to love others by looking at how God has loved us. So what is his love like? I'm going to use three words here, recognizing that they're inadequate, and they are not describing all that there is to the love of God. In fact, I'm going to name a couple that perhaps we don't think about so much in relation to the love of God. God's love, first of all, I'm going to suggest God's love is righteous. Tongue-tied, always when I try to think about who God is and what his love is like. His love is an ocean. His love extends beyond us. But Paul insists on this understanding of the love of God. When he describes it, particularly in Romans 3, I don't have time this morning to take us there, but you may meditate on Romans 3 when you think about the love of God as being a righteous love. God loves us. Does God love sinners? Our answer is a heartfelt yes, he loves sinners. Does God love sin? And we immediately say, no, God doesn't love sin. And so we come up with this neat little explanation for that. God loves the sinner, he just doesn't love his sin. That it falls short, folks. Our problem is not just that we've done something wrong. We have become sinful. Sin is in us. I've puzzled with this. How can a holy God, a righteous God, love sinners? And we better be careful that we don't give neat little explanations to that difficulty. God's love is righteous. And Paul says that God's love is righteous, and that was one of the reasons Jesus died for us. God can righteously love sinners because of Jesus, because of what Jesus did for us. Again, you may just check the wording, particularly in verses 19 and following in Romans 3 there, where he talks about God is he's righteous in the way he loves. And so when I am instructed by the love of God, I must think about, as I love others, I must think about honoring righteousness as I love. Love does not violate righteousness. In its words, in its actions, it does not violate. It acts in harmony with righteousness, which will mean sometimes that I will actually absorb things myself in order to love others. God's love is also undeserved. Scarcely for a righteous man would one die. Yet, peradventure, for a good man, some would even dare to die. But God commanded his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God's love to us is undeserved. We didn't earn it. We couldn't merit the love of God. It's undeserved. Now, sometimes, unfortunately, our righteousness gets in the way of our love. And so we look at the people around us who don't deserve love, and we say in our hearts, they don't deserve that. You see, our righteousness kicks in there and says, that's not right. God's love for us is not unrighteous, but God's love is undeserved. We are to love others as we have been loved. And so here's the way it is. The love that came down from heaven into my heart was not dependent primarily upon the recipient. Let's back up here. Let's go back again to that question. How can a righteous God love sinners? One of the ways, my feeble attempts to understand this, has been putting it together this way. Okay, God's love, typically we think of love as, because it's supposed to be reciprocal, okay, that this person who's not treating me right doesn't get any. Okay, I've had it. You ever find yourself saying, that's enough, I've had it? Is his love like that? How can he love the unrighteous? One of the ways I've understood that is that God's love is poured out on sinners because it's dependent on its source rather than on its recipient, or more than on its recipient. An illustration perhaps will help us. You like flowers. Why do you like flowers? One of the reasons I like flowers is because of the aroma. They give off that wonderful aroma. Some flowers are especially, roses especially, just that beautiful aroma. And we stick our noses into them and do all kinds of things like that and just enjoy that aroma. What if, now what's that aroma dependent on? Is it dependent on you? Why does a rose smell like a rose? What if the aroma of a rose depended upon its recipient? I tell you, sometimes some people sticking their nose in there would not get would not get that beautiful aroma. It would smell like a skunk or whatever, okay? You get what you deserve. The aroma comes out of the rose because it is a rose, and the smell comes out, it's dependent upon the source, not the recipient. And so our love to others, yes, we do want it to be a reciprocal relationship, but our love for others is to be like the love of God, that it depends upon its source. It comes out of us because we have become love. In Him, we have become loving. When you are struggling with loving somebody, when I'm struggling with loving somebody, I have to come back and say, you know, the reason I'm struggling with loving this person is because I'm looking at the recipient. God's love comes out of Him, and that's how He loves the undeserving, because it's in Him to love. God's love also is essential, then. It is like the rose, it's essential. It comes out of the essence of God Himself. It's who He is. Now, I don't know here. Okay. There's one more word here that I would like to think about, and apparently I don't have it on my outline here. God's love is sacrificial. That also characterizes the love of God. We enjoy the sacrifice of others for us. God's love is sacrificial. You cannot love in a fallen world without sacrifice. Now, there was an author I heard about recently, some time ago, I guess it's been a while ago. I was listening to this guy being interviewed. He was a Canadian author, and that doesn't explain anything here, but he was a Canadian author, and the thesis of his book was, you don't compromise who you are for anybody. And he said, that's how you have a fulfilled life. And so the person interviewing him said, well, are you married? He said, no. And he said, well, have you ever dated? Yes, I have. He said, so if you were going on a date and your date wanted chicken and you wanted steak, what would you do? He said, I'd go where there's chicken and steak. No, I said, if you had to do the choice, no question, I'd go where there's steak. You don't compromise for anybody. Neat world, wouldn't it be, huh? Relationship that includes no sacrifice is never going to be meaningful. Love sacrifices. I don't mean it sacrifices anything, but love gives itself because it is committed not to yourself, but to the good of others. I came across a story some years ago comes from the Korean War. In South Korea, a Christian civilian was arrested. And he was by the communists, and he was a civilian, but he was a Christian man who ran an orphanage. The young communist commander ordered this man to be shot on the spot. And then he found out that this Christian man runs an orphanage. And so in cruel irony, he said, oh, don't shoot him. Do you have any children? And found out this man had a 19-year-old son. He said, bring him. And he shot the 19-year-old son in front of his father. Sometime later, the tides of war changed. This communist commander was captured, and he was tried and sentenced to death. the Christian man who had run this orphanage found out about this, and he went and he pleaded for the life of this communist. And his reasoning was, he said he was young and foolish and didn't understand all the implications. He said, "Give him to me. I will care for him." Took this young man into his home. The young man became a Christian and a pastor in later years. Sacrificial love is powerful. You cannot love in a fallen world without pain. But what about Christian teachers? Most of us in our schoolrooms don't experience that extreme situation where we are shot or our children are. Most of us. I'd like to revisit 1 Corinthians 13 now and think about teachers. Began by saying, according to this passage, love is important. If we do all the things that teachers are to do, we never get done. Is that right? So it's easy to neglect first things. It's easy to neglect love. Before I read this, I want to pull your minds again to the reality that love is of God. And so I don't want you thinking from this session, going back to your private times and thinking, how can I love this student? And I'm not going to give up. I am going to love this student, and here's how I'm going to love this student. If you're struggling with loving a student or a teacher, fellow teacher, or a parent, or a board member who's giving you grief, the best place to go is to your knees. Love is of God. We won't have it by determining. We won't have it just by saying, I'm going to, by gritting our teeth. Love is of God. It is born out of brokenness. It is born as we interact with the one who has loved us. 1 Corinthians 13, beginning with verse 4 now, with a rather loose paraphrase. Love explains the second time and the third without scolding. Love puts an arm around an embarrassed student. Love is grateful to teach alongside a teacher who has outstanding classroom management and knows it. And when it's reversed, when the classroom management of a fellow teacher is classroom disaster, love is more ready to listen than to talk. Love models good manners, courtesy, and respect, even when addressing adolescent boys whose identity is measured by noise. Love is more focused on making better students than making a good impression. Love looks for creative ways to turn irritations into moments of humor and frustrations into events of learning. Love makes a daily habit of mentally rehearsing what students did well. And years later, when a former student says, "Do you remember all the grief I gave you?" Love is happy to draw a blank and reply, "No, actually, what I remember is how you put everything into our ball games. I never had a student who could run like you." Love enables a teacher to know that when criticized for not doing enough and for doing too much in the same situation, he probably did a pretty good job. Love never trivializes what a parent says. Love looks for what students can become and stays focused there. Love doesn't quit. school years will pass by, lessons will be forgotten, facts will change. But we will remember love, because love is of God. It comes from Him and leads to Him. Yes, we will remember love because love is of God.